Last week, we began a study on the Bible. Now, not meaning how we got the Bible, who contributed to it, or when it was written, not that kind of stuff, or what language it was written in. We focused on the Bible in terms of what it is, why, by its very nature. Where does it fit in the classification of things? We have, how would this game go? You have things, places, people, you know, rocks, whatever, you know, different kind of ways of classifying things. So that's what I'm talking about, classifying the Bible. What kind of thing is it? How is it known, or by what is it known? We could explain the Bible as God's word. That'd be a classification. As given revelation, that would be okay, which is true. And it meets our spiritual needs, which is true, but still doesn't get to the question. Our question is, at least in the beginning, to establish the nature of the Bible. The Bible is something by its nature, and I mean the cover to cover without index and footnotes. So the basic inherent features of something, especially when seen as characteristic of it. How do you know something? By it. The innate or essential qualities of or character of a person or animal, we could say what it is that makes it a thing. It is a whatever. So this is stretching a little bit. Inborn and hereditary characteristics as influence or determinant of personality. Well, we're going around the edges of it a little bit. Well, trying to find out what it is, we can limit a lot of things, what it's not. So we can speed up by just looking at what things that are in writing, the written language used to communicate. Look at those things. Somebody suggested the Bible is a love letter from God. You probably have heard that. You know, that's God's love letter to us. Somebody suggests that it is God telling man what is expected of him. We sort of get the idea of a law here. Somebody suggests that we really do not know what it is because it's of God, and anything from God is not understandable. So it can't be reduced to a nature. God is infinite, therefore any attempt to restrict God will end in a horrible mistake. So don't even try to say what the Bible is. It's just something that we have. It comes from God. It's God's word. Don't define it beyond that. So last week we suggested that the Bible in its nature is, in essence, a contract. Now, what is a contract, or what is the essence, the intrinsic nature or indispensable quality of something, especially something abstract that determines its character? We could add fundamental to our list. What is the Bible fundamentally? Well, it is a contract. And if we take away the contractual elements, it ceases to be a contract. Just a bunch of words then. Sometimes it's noted as the sine qua non of it. And we have that of sine qua non issue of dispensationalism is the glory of God, the division of Israel and the church. And what was the third one? the literal reading of Scripture. Three things. We call that sine qua non. If without those three things, you don't have a dispensationalism. So we listed various kinds of contracts. Remember, a contract is achieved just and simply the meeting of the minds. Sometimes it's putting in writing, usually if you want to remember what you did. The contract is often written so terms can be examined and, of course, remembered. No, we didn't agree to that. Yes, we did. Did you put it in writing? Well, yes, we did. What the writing says is what you agreed to, right? You signed it. And we have this in writing. Now, here's an important point here, that it is not to be altered. You know, you have a written contract, and somebody, you know, later on comes to you and say, well, that's not what it says. And see, I marked out this word over here, and I put in this, you know, piece of property rather than this piece of property, which is worth a lot more. So, no, you can't do that. You can't alter the contract. And that's one reason we need to talk about this as a contract, because contracts cannot be altered in the middle of it. All right, so we have a contract written with terms in it that are to be remembered because that's why it's in writing, and it can't be altered, and that's why it's in writing. So a contract works. So remember that any agreement by any other name, known as agreement, by any other name is still a contract. So is an agreement a contract? Could be, yeah. So the nature of a contract is that it obligates the parties. A contract is a promise to something. Now, I'm saying the Bible is this. The Bible is this contract. It obligates parties or a party. And it's a promise to do something. All right? So we have many occasions to enter into contracts. Talked about different kinds of things last week. I'd add one more to it. Signing a credit card charge is a promise. It is a contract. It is a promise to pay. Why, you never thought about that. Well, then read the print of your credit card agreement. Credit card what? Agreement. That's what it says. The agreement on the top says agreement. Remember, it's still by another name, is still a contract. So the lawyers for the Visa card understand that credit card charges are obligations, and they try to head off any possible harmful action against their company by non-payment. So they know it's a contract. That's why you have all this fine print. Now, we have two-party contracts, very common. One-party contracts, very common. Even sometimes we have things that are in our hands, like a credit card. We might not even think about it as a contract. But just because you don't know what it is doesn't mean it's not what it is. So if you don't think about a credit card signature as a contract, that's what it is. Now, a personal check is or can be a one-party or two-party contract. A last will and testament can or cannot be, need not be, a one- or two-party contract. It depends what's in it. So it depends what the term of the contract, whether it is one-party or two-party. Now, we talked about a will. Will with conditions make it a two-party contract. Now, I'll do it again. Will with conditions. There's an if in there. If there are conditions like if, then it's a two-party contract. Somebody else has to perform outside the will maker. Interesting, in this case, the second party of a will does not need to sign anything. In fact, he may not even know he has violated the terms of the will unless somebody told him about it. Remember, the will was, I'll give you my estate if you don't leave the state of Nebraska before you're 21. And that's a condition. And if he doesn't know that and he just goes to Kansas for an ice cream cone, he just forfeits his entire estate, didn't know about it. So he doesn't need to know about the conditions. But the conditions still apply. So with a will, without conditions, it becomes a one-party contract. So we began this series to show that the Bible is, in its raw being, a contract. That is, after all is said and done, what is this library? 66 books written over 1,500 years by many authors in multiple languages covering a wide variety of subjects. Is it an encyclopedia? Well, it could be, but no. Is it a history book? Well, it could be, but it's not. So by its very nature, we believe that the Bible is a single-party contract. Now, we need to grasp God's obligation in terms of a contract. That's why we're doing this. He made with, this contract, by the way, he made with himself. Although I'm going to explain, it says he made it with Abraham. I'm going to explain that. But the contract is actually made with himself. And some say, well, how can you do this? I think I said this later on, but I'm going to say it here. He said, well, God swears by himself because he can't swear by no other. So it's the same kind of thing. You know, God makes a contract. If you don't like that, then you can say, well, there are three persons in the Godhead, and the contract is made with all three of them agreeing. All right, so you can say there's an understanding about the three if you want to say it that way. I'm not sure that's right. Try that. You know, sometimes you say things that don't make sense in a year from now, but I don't know if I like that. I just think it's good enough to say that God made it with himself, which is like a will. If a will has no conditions, then it is a contract with himself. I obligate myself to do this. So we need to grasp God's obligation in terms of a contract he made with himself to perform predictable acts. How much of the Bible is prophecy? These are predictable acts that God's going to perform. And we get the chance over time, now in our station of life, 2,000 years after Christ approximately, we're invited to observe these facts. We can go back into history and observe not only the contract, but how the contract was exercised, how it was executed, how did it work out? Were the terms in the contract, are they being met? Were there some violations? However, we don't like this maybe, if we tend to view the Bible as a collection of examples of lofty ideals, love letters from God and so forth, then to describe it in mundane courtroom languages in lowly terms seems degrading and not very spiritual. And I would like to drag you into the real world, not the spiritual world. I think God lives in the real world. You ever notice that the political left lives in an imaginary world and the conservative tend to live in more in a real world? There's a mix. But I think God lives in a real world, and I think he likes what he made. He judged what he made, but I think he likes what he made. So don't have this idea that somehow this what God does is somewhere else. No, what God does is here. It's what we touch, what we feel, and what we see, so forth. So let's don't get into the trap saying, well, this is such spiritual talk, we don't want to talk about it in lowly terms. No, God is a lowly person. He talks to us in lowly terms. So, maybe even further out, some may prefer to leave the Bible as a mystery and let each one gain his own personal inspiration. I'm afraid this is where a lot of people live with their Bible. It looks nice on the table. You know, we looked at it once in a while, and we have the family record in the front. And we might even have, as I'll say in a minute here, we may have plaques on the wall with certain Bible verses that somehow they work, we like. And that's the extent of the Bible. You know, it's an influence in our life, but nothing more. Now, we should obey it. I mean, there's some good things in it. Don't get me wrong. I'm speaking for them. But it's not much more than that. It's not more tightly held than that. But I want to make it important to you to expand your appreciation for the Bible, that it is usable and it has valuable terms. And it is something of worth rather than just a source of verse for the wall. Okay, now, the contract, first of all, obligates somebody, whoever's named. And there are other things besides the obligation to make this contract, and the issues are whatever's in it must be clearly spelled out. And this becomes difficulty for lawyers because what one lawyer understands a word to mean may mean totally something else by another lawyer. So you know, sometimes you, and you've maybe been involved in this, I have been, in writing contracts, and you're, you know, kind of acting like a lawyer, you know, you can write it down, and then Jim Titus gets hold of it and says, no, you don't want to do that. You don't want to do that. These are not the right words, because this is not, well, maybe I say this is not legal ease, because if I use this word, the lawyers don't know what that word means, but if the lawyer used this word, the lawyers know what this word means. So we substitute words that lawyers understand to put in contracts. So the obligation is understood by the parties. So the terms must be clearly spelled out. There should be no ambiguity. And my lesson next week will be about the literal reading of Scripture. That has got to be a point in our reading of our contract. We're going to do that as another lesson. So with this, the terms must be clearly spelled out means that they must be understandable. So the parties must be named. They can't have party X. It has to have a name in it, sometimes even with a middle name, so we don't get confused with the wrong Don Gertson. There are a few others. The parties or events must be excluded. Now, like in the Abrahamic covenant, we're going to find that it's Abram, Isaac, and Jacob, and not Esau, right? So Esau is excluded. Abram, Isaac, and Jacob. So they're excluding some. So maybe in a will you might say, I want to give this to my son, and I don't want to give to any of my other children. You might say it twice just to make sure they understand that you knew you had other children. So the nature of the obligation, the value received, has to be in the contract. What is it that's being conveyed here? And sometimes you even have a value to it. You know, when you give property sometimes or exchange it, you sometimes the value is at least a dollar or more. You know, so you have that kind of thing. There's a value attached to it. And then you have some kind of limits of time. If it doesn't say their limit, said this goes on for 5 years, like you have a contract to repay something, you got to do it within 5 years or whatever. But sometimes it doesn't say anything about time at all. So it's assumed it's in perpetuity. It's in perpetuity. So this may be too personal, but I got to tell you, I got started on this. You know, I don't want to tell you all this stuff. But anyway, when my dad lived in Grant, he farmed. And when he died, he left the land to the kids. Process. Well, recently, we divided up the property. And what I got me is I got the deed between my brothers that he signed that he didn't own it anymore, and I signed that he didn't own the property I own anymore. So and then we own our own property separately. And I looked at that piece of paper, which was filed at Perkins County, had the names on it, the property, you know, everything I said here is on there. And I thought to myself, you know, here I have a piece of paper. And do I understand the value and the power of words on a piece of paper, what it does? It's filed in the county house at Perkins County, and it will be there in perpetuity. I mean, I may die, but I got estates, whatever. So I got thinking about how significant a contract is and how binding it is on the parties. I said, just a piece of paper, you know, written by somebody on this computer, and two people signed it, and then it was recorded in the county, which is only a matter that it makes it a public issue. So anyway, here we have a contract similar to that. I thought, similar, if this thing is that meaningful to me, when God enters into a contract with humanity through Abraham, somehow it ought to have the same meaning to us. That's where I got started on this whole thing. Not that you need to know that, but it was one of those things. I said, well, I could tell you that on your house. You bought a house. But a lot of times these things go by so quickly. I know when we bought our house last time, 12 years ago, I signed probably 35 pieces of paper. I have no idea what I was signing. And it said, now you own the house. So you never get the sense of really that this ownership transfer happened and that you actually had this piece of paper that actually said it did, because you were in a hurry to get to coffee. So that's why I took this time to tell you a little bit why I thought this was significant, because I actually saw it happen. And if this happened in our mundane world, just apply that to the world where God lives and how he deals with us. And you know, I'm ahead of my story here, but God gave Abraham a piece of land. Yep. It's not filed at Perkins County Courthouse or the Lancaster County Courthouse, but it is filed in the places where the deeds are kept in heaven. And we're going to find out that what God meant, what he said, he really meant. So we have all these things that are underneath a contract. So it's a valid term to explain what the Bible is. Other things about contract, it can be voided if the parties do not act freely. You know, you sign this or you're dead. I mean, that doesn't make contract, that makes it one invalid. Parties are unable mentally. Well, there may be some questions about that. You know, get somebody in a corner and make them sign something that's not able to. Older persons, sometimes they're put in a corner like this, and then the heirs come back and challenge it. I talked about the guy that gave the caretaker, his 16-year-old caretaker, a new car, and the heirs objected. You know, so maybe there's some mental instability here. So, no, the guy just appreciated what she was doing for him. You know, maybe he's not mentally unstable at all. Anyway, so the parties are underage. You can't have contracts. You know, you can't marry underage. Marriage is a contract. Did you know that? A marriage is a contract. What's a covenant? What's the difference? Okay, there are conditions that are illegal. You can't bind somebody to do something that's wrong. And then the parties that cannot perform its terms obviously make it illegal or invalid, not to do anything with the contract we have with God, or God has with us, I should say. So in my pretty little letters here, we are spending a lot of time on this question, because as we move into the Bible claims, we must have a good grip on what we're handling. It is a contract from God, or is it some ideas that may somehow work out? Now, this is about where I started to lose it. Covenant theology is the most nonsensical system that you could devise. And it has one intent. This is not in my lesson. This is what I was going to try to tell you. So I'm going to try to tell you without writing it down. Covenant theology has one intent. One intent, and that is to remove the Jews out of God's promises. That's it. That's it. Now, they moved the Jews out of the promises of God in the early church. By the middle of the second century, this already was on the way. And the church has followed suit since then, through Constantine, through Augustine, through the Reformers, up through R.C. Sproul. That whole chain is the same chain. The same arguments go clear through. Oh, well, although it wasn't until the 17th century that somebody actually put this into some kind of words that made sense, quote, sense. You know, how could God reject the Jews? Well, no one really answered that question until the 17th century. And then somebody said, well, this is how he did it. And how he did it is what I try to explain to you. And when I'm done, it doesn't make any sense to me. Okay, so we have watershed issue between covenant theology and what we call dispensational theology. So the question is a little bit over, is it a covenant or is it a contract? Is it a covenant over a contract? I said, we're not even arguing the right thing here. Can't you agree that a covenant is a contract? How can I even go on discussing anything? But we are dealing with watershed issues. That's why I put this pyramid up here. We are dealing with watershed issues. We must go to the place of separation where this assumption is made before we go on, because whatever side you choose, that's the side you're going to live on the rest of your life. You don't get down to the 20th century and decide, well, we need to tweak each other a little bit here and we'll get along. No, you got to go back where the error was made. And the error is made back in the assumption of what do we have? What is the Bible? What does it actually say? Well, we have one side says that the contract is conditional. And they want to call it a covenant. So this side, this would be the covenantal side. This one side says that God entered into a covenant. They don't want to use contract here. They want to use covenant. For them, it's a softer word. God entered a covenant with Abraham that it was, but that it was conditional. That's why it's a covenant. I mean, that's not right. I don't want to confuse you. But they say it is. So this line of thinking does not like the idea of a contract, since it provides no condition or wiggle room to get Abraham out. I said it as plain as I can say it. They want to get Abraham out of this covenant. And do everything, including standing on their head, to do it. And it's been going on for 1,600, 1,700 years, whatever. The other side says, our side, the contract is unconditional, that God entered into a covenant with Abraham, but that it was unconditional. This line of thinking accepts the idea of a contract, and I will be okay with covenant, since it suggests a faithfulness of God keeping failing Abraham secure. Now, when you get into covenant theology, they harp a lot about the covenant of grace. The covenant of grace is where God unilaterally does something for his subject. God saves somebody by grace. There are no strings attached. It is one side. It is unilateral. It is unconditional. Our salvation is that way. But when you come to Abraham, no, God dealt with him differently. Well, that's why we're doing this. God entered into a contract with Abraham as he's entered into a contract, quote, with us. That it's by grace and not by conditions. We're not saved by grace plus. So they want to use grace. They have a covenant of grace. And I said, all we're saying is apply grace to where it needs to be applied, and that's to Abraham. So we have this prejudiced thinking that starts which side you're going to go down. It's not from the text. There's a priori issue, in other words, what you decided ahead of time, that's called prejudicial thinking. There's an assumption that God has jettisoned the Jewish promises. The disobedient Jews failed so miserably that God has replaced them with obedient Gentiles. And they don't always say the church. They just say Gentiles. Now, if I look out across the scape, I see Lincoln over here. I see a lot of Gentiles. Do I see very many obedient Gentiles out there? Well, why are they credited with this performance that I don't see? Neither were the Jews all saved. So this obedient Jews failed so miserably that God replaced them with the obedient Gentiles. Where are the Gentiles obedient? Now, since I've decided that, their big task is to make the Bible support the idea of getting rid of Abraham. So how much of the Bible do you think you have to rewrite for this to work? An awful lot. And this is where it gets frustrating. And if you start living in the life where the Bible has been reorganized, let's say you grew up in this kind of system, you don't know about the system where you actually take it for what it says. You don't know about that. You just take it for what somebody else says it is. You live in that forever, for 20 years, 30, 50 years. How in the world can you look over here and see those guys as being right? They look weird. Sproul calls it, this is silly. Sproul called our view silly. Silly. Now, if anything is silly, it's taking the Bible and dismantling it, putting it back together you want to put it together. Now, that's silly. But they don't see that. They don't see that because they've been in this culture. All right, so the sleight of hand has happened a long time ago, and it just is perpetuated. The argument goes like this. If the covenant is not binding or is conditional, then when the descendants of Abraham failed their obligations, God is justified. See, that's what they're looking for. God is justified in expelling the Jews and inserting in new people. God is justified. We have to get God to justify his change of plan with Abraham. Well, if Abraham fails, well, God is justified. You know, that's how we think. If you failed, I'm going to give it to somebody else. But if it is a binding, unilateral, and unconditional contract, then God must be faithful to Abraham regardless of his failings. That's what we call grace. Grace. But on the other hand, this denies the new Israel, the church, the Gentiles, a place, since the odd old Israel lives to inherit the promises. They can't have that. They can't have that. So I'll stand on my head, make sure that doesn't happen. I'll go against common sense even to make sure that doesn't happen. So we summarize contracts and covenants. They want to make a deal of those two things. They're really not any different. A contract and covenants are legally doing the same thing. For example, sometimes you have properties, some of you own homes, and they have restricted covenants written in the deeds or the property description, ownership. An example, your neighborhood may have these kind of covenants. For example, some will not allow construction of an unattached building beside your house. I know that's probably in my neighborhood. I don't know. There's a lot of covenants in my neighborhood, what you can, what you can't do. So this is a restriction on your use. And it's a law. It's a law. In fact, the sheriff could actually come out and do something, you know, cite a warrant that you violated the law by building the tool shed in their backyard. My son-in-law, Scott, built a tool shed in his backyard. For some reason, he is the only guy in his whole neighborhood that doesn't have the restricted covenant on his property. That's really true. Because I think the guy that developed it was going to own that lot, and then he sold all the other ones, must have wanted to keep this for himself so he didn't have to violate, so he didn't have to abide by the covenant. So Scott's got a nice tool shed in the backyard, and no one else can. So, can you imagine the neighbors going around, hey, you can't do that. You can't do that. Well, here's one says you can. See, so it's a law. The restricted covenant is a law. In this case, the law doesn't cover this particular lot, so he could build his tool shed. Okay. So this covenant is just as enforceable as any other, no matter what you call it. And not why we call them covenants. Somehow they're softer. The idea that a covenant is not binding or different than a simple contract is flat wrong. Try it sometime. So here we have the Bible, basically, the documents. We say the first part of the document, the first 11 chapters, are the preamble. A contract has to sit in an environment. Where it is, who it is, what's happened, some history. So we have our creation, and we have all the floods. We're down to Abraham, all right? So all the history before that is necessary to get to the point where God's going to make a contract. Remember, I did this for you last week. I'll do it again. So every contract needs some context for which it to live and to be enforced. There would need to be an iteration of places, people, things, and events that have brought about the need for a contract, which is Genesis 1 through 11. Then we might use language like this: whereas God has exhausted the opportunities given man to make reconciliation with his creator, God unilaterally assumes his sovereign right to craft peace for man, one on his own terms and at his own expense. I did another one for you. I won't do that again for you. But so there are things that are said that would set out why this contract is needed. Now, probably it doesn't have to be there. You could do this whole thing without it. In fact, you can do this whole thing without putting it in writing. God could have just gone off and done his thing. And we were just fortunate that they put it in writing so we could see what he's doing. Because what it does, it confirms the very character of God, that his word is good. Because what he said he would do, he is going to do. And that confirms our joy, contentment with God who we serve. So don't get too confused here that every word is a contractual statement, but all relates to the contract. And this is how the contract is set up. And I say, well, at this point, you got to say, well, God, I don't say God's tried everything. That's probably good enough to say it that way. So, but finally, at last, he's going to try one man instead of a group of people to save each other or be saved. He's got to go down and reduce it to one man and work through one man. And we know the story. It comes down to Jesus Christ. That one man. But in the process, he has a whole family, a whole nation, a whole system to support and so forth. Part of the contract. And by the way, he's going to do this at his own expense, which we'll see in the lessons that are coming down. So the way I like to think about the Bible is that the contracts are the spine of the book. It holds all the pages together because every part of the Bible is hooked to the contract in some way. You can't just pull this out. It's all part of the contract. So the binding of the Bible holds together the place and the order of each page and each idea and each purpose and each people down to the last iota, tittle, whatever the Hebrew's words are. It's all hooked together. Nothing is off by itself. It's all related to the whole. And that's exactly how the contract of God is held together, by every statement in the Bible. So all you need to do is destroy the concept that it is a contract and the Bible falls apart. Because what's going to hold it together? My idea? My scholarly wisdom? No, that won't work. Although they try, and they will substitute it. So we have these things that are offered in this contract. We have land, seed, and blessing. Is the way we talk about it. We'll develop these as separate contracts, but they're all within the contract, the subsets in the main contract. The land part of the earth, the physical part of the earth, real estate kind that Larry used to sell, maybe still does, I don't know. We have seed that's plural would be a lot of people, and the seed comes down to Christ. They're both in this promise. Then we have also a blessing, which is deliverance, and maybe sometimes we want to use the word happiness here, and we've got attached to this, our new birth is part of the blessing, because how in the world can you enjoy anything without the new birth? So those are the three contracts. And notice how often in this brief look at the contract, the words I will show up. I know I've highlighted them, make it easier for you. But there are five times it says, God says, I will. And there are twice it says, you shall or you will or you can or I will make for you. So that gives seven times in these three verses. Actually, you get it down to, three verses. Let's use all three of them. Seven times that God says he's going to do something, and that's it unilaterally, unconditionally, for Abraham. And their land, which is the real estate, the seed is the nation, seeds and seeds is Christ. The blessing is the blessings, a general blessing. And the new birth is obviously part of the blessing, because how can you enjoy anything without the new birth? So these are the four provisions of the Abrahamic covenant, or the, not say conditions, not the right word. First of all, it is one-sided, that it is an agreement that has only one party. Only one party is obligated to act. Okay, it is one-sided, which is unilateral. Unilateral, one party. Notice I told you, five will, I wills, there are no you musts to Abraham. Two additional ones said, you shall and in you. So make seven unilateral declarations of God concerning something about Abraham, what he's going to do. Unilateral. That leads us to another one. Next one is leads to an unconditional agreement, that this agreement is unconditional. It's not only just by one party, but there are no conditions. There are no ifs, then, or else ideas connected to it. It's only statements, I will statements, I will statements. So Abraham is a receiver of the gift, whether he is agreeable or not. And we'll show later on that God signs the contract. Abraham's off sleeping. All this stuff means something, I think. So there's no limit now to this. It says eternal. There's no limit or generation limits to this. Okay, it goes Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and then it goes on without a limit. The agreement will be into the eternity, the favor, the forever as owned by God. So this is an eternal agreement. Doesn't expire. Like the Seventh-day Adventist said, it expires when the match burns out. So the match has had its eternity. No, that's not the kind of eternity God has. God has one that doesn't end. Now, this agreement is not with any other of the world occupants except for Abraham. And we have to include Sarah here as a unit. Abraham's the family of Abraham. A seed, a family, is implied in the provision of a great nation. Remember, Abraham has no children when this is given. So we have the four things there. And I want to explain a little bit what this, later on it'll come up. It says, well, God did make a covenant with Abraham. See, Abraham had a part of this covenant. It says, on that day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham. Now, this is a reiteration of the same covenant. You can say it again and again and again. Same covenant, all right? And the day of the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, to your descendants I will give this land from the river Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. And then it also says that another place, I just give you one. As we'll see, when the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, the Lord was not asking Abraham to agree to be responsible for any aspect of the covenant. Nor was Abraham to be a signatory of the agreement only that Abraham was to be the recipient of the provision. That's how the Lord made a covenant with Abraham is to be understood. Now, if we don't understand that, we just look how it worked out. And that's how it worked out. And it works out that way really quickly. It doesn't take the end of the Revelation to figure that out. So we have things that are easily remembered. And by the way, if some of you have been around a long time, this is old Bible walkthrough stuff, repackaged a little bit. So we remember real quickly the Abrahamic covenant covers land, seed, and blessing. Three things. That's what Abraham's going to get. And they're explained in for the covenants later on. The conditions of these are that God made this promise unilaterally by himself. They're without conditions. Abraham cannot fail it, cannot sin it away, cannot be disqualified. These provisions go on forever. There's never a time when this is not going to work. There's no time when the church comes in and assumes a position. And it is limited to Abraham. It's not with the other people of the world, Abraham, Sarah, those descendants, which is obviously clear to Abraham. So we have then the easily remembered land, seed, and blessing, unilateral, unconditional, eternal, and with Abraham. Now, all you got to do to destroy the Bible is destroy that contract. It's like taking the spine off the Bible, you just cut it off, and you throw the Bible into the air, and the pages come down in some kind of random order, and you try to put them together, make some sense out of it, and there you have covenant theology. They try to make some sense out of these random ideas that have been put together, and so they pick up on, see, now, well, God must be a God of... He must be, well, then we can do this. And we know that God rejected the Jews, so the Jews can't have a soup, so we can't put these pages in this order, so it excludes the Jews because the Gentiles really are in charge here. So we got to line everything up so the Gentiles are in charge. And whenever there's anything about the Jews getting anything, that obviously hasn't been spiritual. It's already been fulfilled. I'm starting to stand on my head. I'm getting dizzy.